I often address received language, and we're drowning in it, and it kills consciousness and sensitivity. If you get used to saying things like "repeat, felon," Indigo will chuckle at this because I told him about eating at a table with a five-year-old daughter and a seven-year-old son the other day in Berkeley, and they were asking the father if it was anything to this business of babies being raised by wolves. And the father said, "Yeah, there is. There's actual historical evidence of children who have been reared by wolves." Because unlike, this is a Berkeley conversation, unlike the founders of Rome, Romulus and Remus, who were mythical. So the boy's thinking about this, and he says a couple minutes later, "Kid raised by a wolf would grow up to be a repeat felon." And I thought, wow, this is amazing. This kid's kind of weird. But we hear repeatedly those kinds of phrases, you know, enemy insurgent and preemptive strike and plausible deniability and all of this. And we file them away and we repeat them, and then we realize they don't really mean anything. You can't really get very far in thinking with that. So we're awash in them. And I remember the days of flying in the late 20th century, circa 747 era, which seems like a romantic period now. You have two levels on the plane. You could go upstairs and play the piano and make yourself a sandwich and have long conversations, and computers have not compelled the airlines to pack every plane, steerage style. So I used to love to fly. Now it's become very hellish. But there used to be a sign when smoking people used to be in the back, and it would say, "Please extinguish all smoking materials." And I always thought about this little old guy in the back of the plane who's stomping on this burning blanket. You know? "In the unlikely event of a water landing, like all other journeys, like all voyages, like all the trips we take by choice or unbidden, worldly travel shakes down to a sequence of crises that rise and fall away, grow and pass. And so it must be with stories, lives, and cosmological fricassees. First, you think about the move. What will you need? What happens to the space you're leaving behind? Who will water your plants? Should you trust that soup in the fridge to spoil, or what? What to pack? What to leave? When to leave? Whom to see or duck? Does Paris really drizzle in winter like the Cole Porter lyric suggests? Will Istanbul be cool? And what of getting there? Always carving out a spatial time that can't exist for real. Ever vulnerable to factors of X and Y, to sex and crying babies on otherwise comfortable flights. What of germs, an engine failure, traffic snarls, forgotten passports, spilled coffees, the unlikely event of a water landing?" I always love that phrase. "You for me and me for you," euphemism. "The sudden sight of Tokyo, her soft blue rooftops slicked with rain. King Kong's view of Manhattan, the warm-up glow of London dawning, distant as history, the in-flight announcement over Amman that no alcoholic beverages whatever are allowed in the Kingdom of Jordan, and you're holding a bottle bought in Amsterdam. The soothing slant of uncut sunlight unleashed over the Arctic, where you dream of imagined destinations and mental communities of wishfulness. In the unlikely event of a water landing," she says, "your seat cushion may be used as a flotation device. How about life raft? How about life buoy? How about Huck and Jim adrift up the Mississippi, hidebound for civilization?" These ways we cope with words are feared euphoria.